So we're definitely good. So this is the 24th, and so let me think. Sue is on Patty. Sue Gagnon. So let's see now. What we're doing is we've been exploring the background to William James, quite a lot of background. And we're gradually going there. And so I began with Newton, didn't I, several weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And Newton sort of set up the problem, I guess you could say, and also the approach that more philosophically inclined thinkers would take. Because Newton, remember, refused to frame hypotheses, that was his phrase, and in other words, to speculate on things where the data were simply lacking. And he was just talking about gravity in that passage, nevertheless, the more philosophically inclined thinkers sort of extrapolated from that and generalized. And so we have in Hume and Kant the beginnings of positivism. And of course, my rough and ready definition of positivism, you'll remember, is the idea that if something is knowable, it's knowable scientifically. And if it's not knowable scientifically, it's just not knowable. And of course, I drew my little diagram here, the circle. Everything inside is legit. Everything outside is just, well, either empty speculation or even meaningless. So then we spent, 5-6 weeks or something, just reviewing Hume and Kant, who are very, very similar to one another. But if you were to resurrect Hume or Kant, and you were to say you were a positivist, but Hume and Kant would have said, "I'm a what? What?" Mm-hmm. Because of course you can exemplify a certain movement of thought. Even if it hasn't been named yet, right? I mean, we do that all the time. For example, the ancient Indian philosophers were phenomenologists, really, because they were exploring inner experience. But of course, the word phenomenology would be meaningless to them. That was from the German tradition, from Hegel and on up to Husserl. But retrospectively, we can say, yeah, that's what you were doing, and now we just have a name for it. Maybe we didn't have a name for it before, you were doing it just anonymously, but now we have a name. It's the same kind of thing here. So the name positivism post-dated Hume and Kant. The word positivism actually basically goes back to Auguste Comte. Let's see here. That's C-O-M-T. And his dates are 1798 to 1857. And a French philosopher, obviously. And he is the one who popularized the term. He wrote a lot. And a lot of the works he wrote had the word positivism or positive in the title. The very first one was A Course in Positive Philosophy. And so that's how the word positivism got associated with the kinds of positions that Hume and Kant were defending. So I thought it would be of some interest before we... Hi Ruben. I thought it would be of some interest before we actually get into the pragmatists per se, but I brought Peirce. We're getting close. We're getting closer. Got Peirce here. But before we do that, just to acquaint you just a little bit with Comte, because, it's interesting, and you get a little flavor of it, and this book, pretty thin, is really just selections from his course on positive philosophy, So I just thought I'd read you the first couple of pages of it. And actually, it's the first couple of pages of this work that a lot of his fame rests on. And if you were to ask just the casual person who maybe knows something about Auguste Comte, what did he think? Sure enough, Oh, you know what this camera is? Somebody should have told me this. This camera needs to be re-aimed a little bit here. Yeah, that would be better, I think.
Better?
Oh, yeah, much, much better, yeah. Yeah, if you were to ask somebody who had some sort of passing acquaintance with Kant, what did he think? Probably what you get is what you get out of the first two pages of the Course on Positive Philosophy. The chapter one, this is in the beginning of chapter one, The Nature and Importance of the Positive Philosophy is what it's titled. And here you go. I'm just going to, like I said, I'm going to read down to page three there, top of page three. In order to explain properly the true nature and peculiar character of the positive philosophy, it is indispensable that we should first take a brief survey of the progressive growth of the human mind viewed as a whole, for no idea can be properly understood apart from its history. What he's going to be famous for is the very general philosophy of history that he is expounding in these first two pages. So we're talking about the history of the progress of the human mind, he says. In thus studying the total development of human intelligence and its different spheres of activity from its first and simplest beginning up to our own time, I believe that I have discovered a great fundamental law to which the mind is subjected by invariable necessity. The truth of this law can, I think, be demonstrated both by recent proofs furnished by a knowledge of our natural organization, a mental organization, and by historical verification due to an attentive study of the past. This law consists in the fact that each of our principal conceptions, each branch of our knowledge, passes in succession through three different theoretical states. The theological or fictitious state, right? I mean, positivism in its genesis was, as you know now, always anti-religious. Certainly Hume and Kant are skeptical of what we would call religious doctrines or theological dogma or something like that. So anyway, state number one, the theological or fictitious state. Two, the metaphysical or abstract state. And three, the scientific or positive state. Now you see the cash value of the word positive or positivism. In other words, the human mind, by its very nature, makes use successively in each of its researches of three methods of philosophizing, whose characters are essentially different and even radically opposed to each other. We have first the theological method, then the metaphysical method, and finally the positive method. Hence, there are three kinds of philosophy or general systems of conceptions on the aggregate of phenomena which are mutually exclusive of each other. The first is the necessary starting point of human intelligence. The third represents its fixed and definitive state. Of course, this is the last word, right? Philosophers always think that their word is the last word. let's see, where was I? And the second is destined to serve only as a transitional method. He could have actually, though, he isn't. He doesn't look at it this way, but I can see it almost as a Hegelian kind of thing where, I'll comment on that later. Hi. Oh, your parents aren't on.
What? No, they're not on. They were going to Zoom it.
No, they're not there.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. By the way, how do you pronounce your last name?
I say Jappé.
There you go. Jappé.
Yeah.
Okay. I've always avoided saying it because I didn't know how to say it.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're talking about Auguste Comte here, and we're talking about his philosophy of history of intellectual history, maybe, as involving three states: the theological, the metaphysical, and the positive state. This is the origin of the word positivism. In the theological state, the human mind directs its researches mainly toward the inner nature of beings and toward the first and final causes of all phenomena that it observes. In a word, toward absolute knowledge. and therefore represents these phenomena as being produced by a direct and continuous action of more or less numerous supernatural agents whose arbitrary intervention explains all the apparent anomalies of the universe. And of course he's thinking, I'm sure, of things like the Greek polytheism and so forth. And every single deity had some sort of domain for which each one was responsible. And that was the explanation of how things worked, because it was under the aegis of deity X. And number two, in a metaphysical state, which is in reality only a simple general modification of the first state, the supernatural agents are replaced by abstract forces, real entities or personified abstractions, inherent in the different beings of the world. These entities are looked upon as capable of giving rise by themselves to all the phenomena observed, each phenomenon being explained by assigning to it its corresponding entity. You could be thinking about Plato's forms, for example, the idea that they're corresponding to our abstract conceptions. There are entities that exist in non-physical, not in space and time, you know. That may be what he's thinking of. I don't know. But certainly Platonism is the earliest of the, well-developed metaphysical theories, otherworldly theories. So, yes, once the human mind gets hold of the idea of thinking in the abstract, it goes hog wild and posits all these abstract entities to understand. They're no longer anthropomorphic. They're no longer supernatural deities or anything like that, but rather they're conceptual abstractions that nevertheless are still held to explain the phenomena of the world in some way or other. I mean, there are many ways of explaining. Maybe one way is just by classifying it under a general concept or something like that. We're not necessarily talking about causal explanations, although we could. Some of you may remember Aristotle's four causes. The material, what's something made of, what is it, what brought it about, and what's its purpose. Four ways of explaining things. They're not all causal in our narrow sense of the word cause. So any of those would suffice. But anyway, that's the second stage. That's the metaphysical stage. And then finally, we come to the positive state. In the positive state, the human mind, recognizing the impossibility of obtaining absolute truth, gives up the search after the origin and hidden causes of the universe and a knowledge of the final causes of phenomena. It endeavors now only to discover, by a well-combined use of reasoning and observation, the actual laws of phenomena, that is to say, their invariable relations of succession and likeness. The explanation of facts thus reduced to its real terms consists henceforth only in the connection established between different particular phenomena and some general facts, the number of which the progress of science tends more and more to diminish. So we are continually diminishing we're all constantly encroaching on the realm of the unknown, bringing that now within the realm of our general scientific theory. We have finally, says Kant, we have finally reached nirvana. It's just a matter of gobbling up more data and more theories and continuing to explain what formerly was a mystery. So a little bit of a final paragraph here. This is sort of the summary, I guess. The theological system arrived at its highest form of perfection when it substituted the providential action of a single being. So monotheism, you're still in the theological stage, of course, but at least it sort of gathers all these pluralistic deities up into the idea of a single being. So that's progress, but it's still in the theological stage. Its highest form of perfection when it substituted the providential action of a single being for the varied play of the numerous independent gods which had been imagined by the primitive mind. In the same way, the last stage of the metaphysical system consisted in replacing the different special entities by the idea of a single great general entity nature, I think you must be thinking of Spinoza here, looked upon as the sole source of all phenomena. Spinoza, in fact, is a monist. God or nature, but don't take the word God too seriously there, is basically all of reality is a single thing, really, and everything within it is just some sort of modification of this single thing. If you ask how many substances are there in the universe, the answer is there's only one. That's the universe itself, and everything inside is just a modification of this holistic kind of thing. In the same way that, I don't know, you might think of a picture, you know, like the Mona Lisa or something like that. Well, you sort of grasp it as a whole, right? And it's the whole that's really what's important there. And the color of her, the shape of her lips or her eyes or whatever are just little modifications that make the whole possible. So that's the kind of idea that the really only substance there for Spinoza is the whole universe, all of nature, which we can call God if we want to, there's only one of them, and all these things that we commonly think of as separate substances are really just modifications of the whole. Anyway, Holmes says that, well, that's analogous to the development of the theological idea, that where you get this monotheism out of polytheism. Well, you know, in the metaphysical stage, we've been working and working. We finally got to the point of Spinoza, where everything is just a single thing. Maybe, I guess it's probably Spinoza he's thinking about. Although the German idealists were going off in that same direction as well. So finally, similarly, the ideal of the positive system, toward which it constantly tends, although in all probability will never attain such a stage, would be reached if we could look upon all the different phenomena observable as so many particular cases of a single general fact, such as that of gravitation, for example. So that would be the scientific ideal, to subsume everything under a single universal law analogous to Spinoza's nature or to the monotheist's God, see. So that's his picture.
Tom, may I ask something here?
Yeah, I've been waiting for you to ask a question, Tom.
Okay, well, I don't want to let you down. So in this case, it doesn't really matter whether the conclusions of the third level are incorrect, as long as you're going about it the right way.
Well, no, but I think he's assuming if you do go about it the right way, your conclusions will be correct.
Well, except, you know, most of old science is all wrong. Mm-hmm. But they approached it in a scientific manner, a positive
right.
manner. It just turns out they were wrong.
Yeah, they didn't have enough data or something like that.
But
sure.
So he's talking really about the process, isn't he?
I think he's talking about both, actually. Now, what you're getting at, really, is a controversy within the philosophy of science, really, or at least during the 20th century, I could say you have sort of two main camps. One camp was represented by the logical positivists, who are very much along the lines of Comte, and the logical positivists held, of course, I've mentioned them many times, that once again, we have this circle and things like ethics and aesthetics and religion and theology, all this are outside and totally to be ignored. In fact, they're meaningless, according to the positivists. But the assumption always was, the assumption always was that science will continue to progress. One thing after another will gradually gobble up the unknown. It may be an infinite unknown, but still, science will continue to progress. But on the other hand, there was another movement in 20th century philosophy of science associated with the name of Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N. You may have heard of Thomas S. Kuhn, who wrote a work called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And Kuhn is talking, you're a Kuhnian, Tom, because... Kuhn
says, There's the giant leaps that Kuhn talked about, as well as the incrementalists.
Yeah, but the thing is, let me finish so you know what I'm talking about. But the thing is, Kuhn says, well, if you're going to study the history of science, if you're going to study the philosophy of science scientifically, you've got to study its history. And so then he has this idea, as a result of studying the history of science, that what you have is a cycle always. And you have a period, a long, long period of so-called normal science, what he calls normal science, which falls under what he calls a paradigm. He's the one who popularized the word paradigm. So there's this paradigm, this picture of the world that people have. And within that picture, you have possibly centuries and centuries of normal science, right? You're just using that same paradigm and you're gobbling up the unknown and bringing it within the fold of knowledge. But always, always, if you look at the history of science, he says, this is what happens all the time, always there's these little anomalies out there, little anomalies that just don't fit in the paradigm. And the tendency is, well, probably somebody made a mistake in the observation, or maybe there's a flaw in our instrument, or some excuse, some way to explain it away. But these anomalies, which at first were just nothing but mosquito bites, they accumulate more and more and more and more, and they build up and they build up and they build up, and then what happens is everything just completely collapses, and you have the scientific revolution. That's the structure of scientific revolutions. Everything, the paradigm collapses, you have chaos for a while, and then eventually a new paradigm emerges, and then once again we have centuries of normal science. So Tom is a Kuhnian because he is saying, if you look at the facts, what was regarded as scientific consensus, or as we like to say now, what's the expression? Settled. That's right. I was griping about that the other day, and I sent out these emails.
Or conventional wisdom, Don.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about, I'm griping about people using the phrase settled science. Since we're now all pragmatists, we're budding pragmatists, the practical effect of that is just to shut off debate, right? You're just saying, truth. You're ignorant. You don't know what settled science. Well, anyway, according to Kuhn, there is no such thing. I mean, or else it's only a temporary settlement. So we have these two paradigms. We have the logical positivist paradigm, where we're gradually advancing in our knowledge, and as long as we adhere to our strictures, never, 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 ever to touch metaphysics, because that's going to get you off onto some tangent that's useless. So forget that, and just confine your researches to what we can confirm empirically. So if we do that, we can be assured that we will continue to progress, right? And then there's Kuhn, and he says, no, that's just not the way historically it works. You may think that this is the end of history, but history has other ideas, right? Well, that's a long answer to your question, Tom. Now, what was your question? I mean, your question was basically an assertion that Kuhn is right, I think. Well, go ahead, though. Just to see if you've done that. Did you have any?
I was okay, because you were affirming that it's really the way you go about obtaining knowledge
is
the key thing.
Yeah.
Not what the knowledge actually is.
Well, but I said I think Comte is with the logical positivist. I think he would say it's both. Go ahead.
Okay.
Question about Kuhn. Where did he come from and when did he live?
Well, I'm sure he's probably dead by now. Latter part of the 20th century was when he was doing his writing. I somehow think he was associated with, like Berkeley or UCL or out in California, I think, but easy enough to Google it.
He died in 1996, Don.
Oh. Okay, there you go. Thank you, Tom. So, did you Google it? I mean, do you know where he would
have? Yeah, I have my computer up.
Is it California?
Well, he taught at Harvard.
Oh, okay, Harvard. All right.
He's an American.
Yeah, well, I knew that. Maybe the book was published by a University of California press or something. Somehow I have that stuck in my mind. Well, anyway, yeah, it's really, really interesting. I really enjoy Kuhn, and one of the great books that I have read is The Copernican Revolution, which was his sort of study, case study, I guess you could say, that led to his overall theory, which was in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. But The Copernican Revolution is just a book of history. Really, really interesting. Well, anyway, but the answer to your question, though, I think Comte is with the logical positivist. So the answer is both in his case. He may be wrong, but I think that's what he thinks. It's both the method and also the results, because this is the final stage of the human intellect, right? We've reached nirvana. It's just a matter of gobbling things up from now on. That's the idea. Now, so any other questions or comments, whatever?
Hey, Don, interesting you should say that, because Kuhn, his little Wikipedia article here, mentions that he's involved in the positivist debate.
Well, yes. Well, that's right. It, on the other side. Yeah. I mean, it's very original. A very original position. And, of course, he was accused of relativism, right? Because, well, heck, if it's just a matter of cycles and we have this paradigm, but in 500 years we're going to have another paradigm, et cetera, et cetera, there is no truth. That's a little bit of a sticky wicket, I think. So, there you go. Well, anyway, back to Comte, though. He was a strange character. I'm not kidding. He was a strange guy. And he spent a while in an asylum. he was befriended by John Stuart Mill. Not that Mill agreed with him up and down the line, but I think at one time he was just virtually ready to go into debtor's prison, practically. And Mill is like what we have now, a GoFundMe type campaign to get him self-sustaining again, because Mill, well, the utilitarians in general were certainly very broadly sympathetic with a scientific orientation, and certainly Comte is that. But the other thing that's really weird and interesting, and well, weird though, about Comte is, of course, he was brought up in a Catholic family. No surprise there. He's French, so yes. But a very religious Catholic family who were appalled at his unbelief, because, of course, he didn't believe a word of it, not a word. And of course, his whole idea is that it's all scientific, and this is outmoded. This is back in the either theological or metaphysical stuff, so we're in a different era now, so we can just dispense with the whole business. But he loved the rituals of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And so he thought that he didn't want to part with that, even though he thought the doctrines were just completely bogus. But so he had this idea of founding a purely secular church, which he called the Temple of Humanity. Mm-hmm. And then instead of a catalog of saints, per se, we would have a substitute catalog of secular saints, those who had done great service to the human race, great writers, great scientists, great philosophers, or whatever, would have this. And then, just as in the Catholic Church, days would be set aside to celebrate the lives of these secular saints. And so he started this quote-unquote church. And, I wouldn't be surprised if, once again, you can Google this one, see if there are any temples of humanity in the U.S. But you know where it really caught on, apparently? Brazil. Apparently there's quite a Comtean sort of movement there in Brazil, where we have all these various temples of humanity, where I guess religious skeptics can go, who still want to have they want to have their cake and eat too, right? They still want the trappings of religion. They want the rituals. I don't know what all you do in a temple of humanity. You probably have music, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, something is more intellectually satisfying than these outmoded ways of thinking as we find in the theological and in the metaphysical stages. So isn't that weird? You know?
Well, very understandable, though.
Yeah, I can get it.
Yeah.
I mean, but he was unusually, I guess, sensitive to the beauty of the... of course, in his day, it was certainly the Latin Mass. That's a big controversy nowadays, right? With the Pope... who was it? Oh, I know. It was in my other biology class. We were talking about that a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, it's beautiful, of course. There's an aesthetic appeal to it. And Comte didn't want to sacrifice that. So there it is.
You know, Don, I really believe in that too, that it's these traditions mm-hmm. that keep the families together.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about morals and principles mm-hmm. and love mankind and mm-hmm. so on. Mm-hmm. That is pretty much the essence
mm-hmm.
of what religion gives to people.
Yeah.
Provide a sense of morals and borders and limits and where, you know, humans should behave, how they should behave.
Mm. So. But of course, as I argued, was it last week, that's a very Kantian view of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Kant basically says the theology is outmoded, but the value of religion is its ethical stance.
Morals.
Yes, the moral part of it. Mm-hmm. And then you could also say the ritualistic part, because we have a good choir in this church, right? We've had an excellent music program for as long as I can remember, and I don't know how far back it goes as far as the quality of it. I mean, we started singing in the choir in 1981. I think it was 1981, and it was certainly very well established then. So we've had a long, long, long tradition of great music here, and that's one of the reasons people come, I think. And that's purely ritualistic. It has nothing to do with doctrine.
Sure.
But of course, in the Methodist Church, we don't emphasize doctrine very much. We're all Kantians without even knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, the last thing I wanted to say about Comte, though, I forgot, I was going to say it earlier, but I forgot. But he doesn't present these three stages in a Hegelian way, although you could think of it that way. When I say Hegelian, I mean the idea of you have a thesis, then you have the opposite, a reaction to it, which is the antithesis, and they, you know, are like that, and then they get melded into a synthesis, which becomes a new thesis, and so forth and so on. That's the idea. And Comte, of course, presents it as a linear sort of thing. We have the theological stage, and we wind up at the positive stage, and the metaphysical stage, he explicitly says, is just a transitional stage from the theological to the positive stage. But honestly, it sounds to me a lot like one could give a Hegelian interpretation of it. Because you have in the theological stage a total absence of abstract concepts, and so the way people understand the world around them is by telling stories. What's the nature of the world? What's the nature of the universe? Well, before time began, there was, you know, Shu and Tefnut and or Re or whatever, you know, some deity or other, and then they copulated, maybe, and then had these offspring, and the offspring are sort of identified with ocean and earth and heaven and all that sort of stuff, like in Hesiod's Theogony, for example. Various stories to explain how things arose. Because why? Because you could say it's a matter of language. They had no abstract vocabulary. They certainly had a vocabulary to explain the ordinary events of human life. And so that paradigm then was used to answer the big questions: where did everything come from? Because those are the linguistic tools that they had available in the Bronze Age. That's what we're saying, and before, right? That's the way they. That's the only thing they had available to explain things. So no wonder it looks to us like very very anthropomorphized sort of explanations, because those were the tools at hand at the time. And then in the Axial Age, as Carl Jaspers would have called it, or did call it, the age roughly from like 800 to 400 BCE, something like that, all of a sudden in various parts, disparate parts of the world, we have this ability to think of the abstract emerging. And nobody knows why. There are all sorts of theories out there, but what happened all of a sudden? But we have then not stories, not events, not a history of something or other, but abstract ideas like causation. Well, that's an abstraction, right? I mean, I'm not talking about A causing B. That's a particular example of instance of that. I'm talking about causation itself. Aristotle, for example, asking the question, what types of causes are there? Well, in asking that question, you're using an abstraction. And then when he divides it up into four different types of causation, those are four more abstractions, and so forth and so on. So all the time, all of a sudden, we have new linguistic tools available, these abstract concepts. So it's like we're going here, where we're just confined to particular events, and going from there to over here, where all of a sudden now we have all these abstract ideas, just the opposite. And so we have this tension here. And then I'm looking at this in a Hegelian way. That's why I'm talking like in these terms. And then what happens? Well, the thing is, just like a typical teenager, when you're rebelling against your parents, what do? You go off to the opposite extreme, right? Too far. You got to be, you know, pull things back a little bit, and you got to pull things back a little bit over here too, right? So, I mean, the abstractions are good. There's nothing wrong with it, but there's such a thing as being too immersed in abstractions or abstractions that are too abstract even. And so you have to clip your wings and come back down a little ways toward earth. You know, not all the way. Now, back in the theological stage, that's where they were, just in the earth. Then the metaphysical stage, you know, they're off in outer space somewhere, and it's empty space. Things are so abstract they don't really have any meaning anymore. You got to bring that back down, but not all the way down. So you have this synthesis. We make use of the abstractions still, but we don't lose sight of the events, of the concretions, as it were. And that's what positivism is all about. If you're using abstract ideas, abstract terms, you gotta somehow link them with specific observations. You can't just go flying off in, you know, linguistic land. You got to schematize them, as Kant put it. You got to translate or explain how they can be translated in terms of concrete observations. That allows you to have your cake and eat it too. We haven't lost sight of this stuff, but at the same time, we haven't given up on abstractions either. We have melded the two together, and that's this positive stage where we've reached the end of history at this point. So says Auguste Comte. Okay? Make sense?
Yeah.
So as I say, even though he presents it as though it's a linear kind of thing, you could understand it as a Hegelian thing. I, for years, was really taken with this. I was thinking along the lines of, I wonder if you can sort of imagine a parallel set of events going from the theological stage to the metaphysical stage, and going from the metaphysical stage to the positive stage. I was mulling those kind of things over in my mind for years and years and years. But anyway, that's where the word positivism comes from. It comes from the name he gives to this third and final stage. Okay? See how much time we have left. We have about 7 minutes. I can get started on Charles Sanders Peirce. So we are gradually inching our way toward William James. We are now talking about the Americans. So we're getting there. Peirce's dates, it's P-E-I-R-C-E, to 1914. Oops. I can't talk and write at the same time. And Peirce, well, if you were to Google pragmatism, you probably would find, I don't know why everything has to come in threes, really, but it does. Peirce, James, and Dewey, that's what you find, Peirce, James, and Dewey. So Peirce is considered to be the founder of the pragmatic school, a purely American offshoot of, which has its roots in positivism. Peirce would not be nearly as famous as he is, and even, I wouldn't say he's famous, I mean, I don't know if anybody here had ever heard of him before, but thanks to William James. I mean, James, as you'll see, we're going to cover this, picked up on especially one of Peirce's ideas expressed in Peirce's essay called How to Make Our Ideas Clear. And William James was pretty famous. He was professor at Harvard and was frequently asked to give lectures. In fact, of the six works of James we're going to cover, three of them are series of lectures. And they're not just little one-time lectures either. They're each of the three is a small book. So he was often asked to give lectures, and he's a good writer, and he certainly of the three pragmatists, if you want to think of him as only being three, but of the three, he's by far the most accessible as a writer. By far, he was a good writer. Unfortunately, a little vague, I think. But maybe sometimes that's inevitable if you write in such a way as to be a more popular sort of writer than somebody like Peirce, who was more technical. Anyway, it does get him into trouble, I will say that, as we will see. But anyway, so we can set the stage for William James, we want to cover Charles Sandage Peirce. And as I said a minute ago, most of Peirce's papers are on the technical side, but he did write six pieces for a magazine called the Popular Science Monthly. I don't know if that exists anymore, but as you can sort of infer from that, it's not as technical as some of his other writing, most of his other writing. Anyway, I'm just going to read you the titles of the six essays. They're really essays. And they're pretty much independent, but the first two kind of go together, the last four kind of go together. We're just going to look at the first two. The first one is The Fixation of Belief. The second one is How to Make Our Ideas Clear. The third one's called The Doctrine of Chances. The fourth one is called The Probability of Induction. The fifth one's called The Order of Nature. And the sixth one's called Deduction, Induction, and Hypothesis. As it turns out, in this particular book, this is an old Library of Liberal Arts. It's too bad. Hackett bought them out. So, but I don't know if this exists anymore or not. But anyway, in this particular book, we have all six of them. The very first six that are in the book are that group. But, as I said, I want to look at just the first two. So I think I want to start at chapter 3 is what I decided, or I mean section 3. Oh, we only have 2 minutes. Well, maybe I should entertain questions if somebody has questions for 2 minutes, so we can, it'll take me more than 2 minutes to go through this. Anybody have any comments, questions, or anything like that? Okay. In that case, why don't we just I don't want to stop in the middle, so let's just stop now, and we will pick it up with the fixation of belief, where Peirce is talking about the four methods of fixing belief, four ways in which people come to conclusions about what they want to believe, which is very interesting in and of itself. And then we'll follow that up with the how to make our ideas clear, which was the central essay that stimulated William James and that began the pragmatic movement. So that's what's coming up next week. So,
yeah.
See ya.
Thanks, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Let me end this.
Your parents are at home.
I'll look at it.
So it comes also like to Bethesda.
Let's see. Ruben, we have Tammy too. Tammy was on.
I'm sure there are. Yeah, they
wanted
to try different churches.
Oh,
Warnett is here.
Yes.
Okay.
You might as well take that thing to Patty. I don't think anybody else needs it.
Amanda's here.
No, it's just for this
one. I know.
Wait, sometimes I think I'm
not
there.
Marty and John are gone. And Logan, Sue, yes.
Jamie, oh, really?
Yeah.
It's a long trip.
Okay. Yeah.
Actually, just yesterday, Gracie, who's living
now,
here,
what did she say?
She went with
her. I'll have to ask her again.
And, well, actually, I don't know.
She said Jay.
The one that I met. The tall Catholic. But she
Sally?
Was my daughter. She's 23.
Oh, you got Sally.
Hi there.
And she said she's going to stay till Christmas.
Yeah.
So she and her friend took my car to Shenandoah. And she said,
Bonnie's not here.
We will see.
Yeah.
2.5 hours and do something and then drive back. I've been lining for my car a lot because.
Yeah, that's everybody.
You know, when I go to Village Green, it's a mile
gee
long.
Gee whiz. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Like with you or with, you know.
It's hardly worth
whatever,
it.
You know, Fetcher or something.
13.
And then yesterday I wasn't planning on using my car, so I just gave it to
her. How does she have another friend here?
Oh, there was a wedding.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a wedding.
Wonderful mask.